Hey everyone, welcome to the Sneaker History Podcast, where we dive into the people, stories, and iconic moments that have helped make sneakers a global phenomenon. If you've ever told someone that you like their kicks, then you're in the right place. Before we lace up this episode, here's a little teaser for you. Stick around to the end of each episode for the last shot question. It's a chance to test your sneaker knowledge and engage with our community. I've also recently started a newsletter to share my knowledge from nearly two decades of experience working in the footwear industry. You can find the link to that below or go to sneakerhistory.com/newsletter for a weekly deep dive into the biggest topics in the sneaker business. All right, now that the business is taken care of, grab your favorite pair of kicks and let's get started with the episode.
Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move! LeBron James with no regard for human life.
Final seconds. Bryant for the win. Bang! Iverson against Gill. The crowd on its feet. Allen for the win.
Welcome to the Sneaker History Podcast.
What up, what up? Welcome back to the Sneaker History Podcast. My name is Nick Engvall, and today I got a special episode for all of you listeners. I'm here with my guy, Brandon Edler. What's up, man?
Hey, what's going on?
So if you don't know Brandon, you probably haven't been into sneakers very long, or you've been under a rock. I don't even know. I couldn't even pin the year that we first met, started talking. Probably like 2011,
yeah,
something like
that's
that.
About right.
Brandon and I worked at for Complex, ran the Complex Sneakers. Man, we started the Complex Sneakers social accounts. That's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Looking at it now.
With a lot of help from Jeffrey Jason, though.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, the pictures he's been posting lately are super dope. Like the angle.
He doesn't get enough love.
Yeah, he's so good. Why don't you give like a quick run through your career?
Not too big of a history, honestly. Got my start at Complex at the beginning of 2011. It was kind of surreal. I was just a really big fan of the magazine, and it was when Twitter was what felt like a true community of people just, you know, kind of talking about sports, music, sneakers, whatever. And I probably slid into every single one of their editors' DMs about 40 times, just letting them know, you know, how great I was, even though I probably really wasn't at that point. And, you know, respect to the GOAT, Joe LaPuma, for, you know, giving me a chance. And I mean, he truly did give me a chance and he truly invested in me, because I remember my first write-up was actually on some Jeremy Scott Camo Wing sneakers for Adidas. And I remember Joe hitting me back later that day, just like really hyping me up. Like I had just wrote the greatest thing ever. And I was just like, I made it. I'm good. Like, this is going to be fun. And I think like 3 days later, I wrote something else. Honestly, I think it was another Jeremy Scott write up for some like teddy bear, like the teddy bear joints or something. And he kind of was like, this wasn't very good. You better step your game up. I was like, damn, dude, I thought I was good. So, I mean, he really pushed me. Like, he was really good at, you know, making sure to build me up on all that and just like hyper focused on what works and what doesn't and why it does. And, you know, he wasn't overly stressing that I was the greatest creative writer in the world, but how do you have a subject matter that people actually care about, and how do you speak to them in a way that's really going to resonate with them? You know, I'm thankful for Joe for that all the time. And then, you know, did that for a little while. Was very fortunate. Ming from Hoop Magazine, which is the NBA's magazine, reached out to me, gave me an opportunity to do some writing from them, some simple stuff, just like some sneaker write-ups, some previews on, you know, new LeBron's coming out, stuff like that. And then, you know, one of my favorite things that I've ever worked on was their 10-year anniversary issue that they did for LeBron James. And he let me have a lot of really good input on that, as well as, you know, the sneaker write-up where we basically just walk through from, you know, his first sneaker through, you know, his last iteration of LeBron that had come out that year. And yeah, man, like when I saw that in print, that was definitely one of my, you know, most exciting days. I remember calling one of my high school teachers and, you know, she's like, I don't know what you're talking about, but I love that you're excited. And that was just kind of how it was. And, you know, to go from there, Finish Line was in Indianapolis. And, you know, a lot of people don't know me. I actually lived in Indianapolis after college for close to 10 years. And when I found that out, got connected with a guy that, you know, had some mutual friends named Evan Wipke, which if you worked at finish line. Whip's like the greatest dude in the world.
Absolutely.
He invited me to come check out the place, and you know, it was cool. Again, if you don't know Finish Line's HQ, which most people don't, they have this little area called the Treehouse. And I just remember at the time it being like very quiet and dead and not a lot going on there. And, you know, fast forward, I get hired and get a chance to go up there, and it got noisy real quick. The music was always bumping. A lot of shenanigans that probably shouldn't have been going on, but you know, I'm forever grateful for that opportunity. And, you know, I really feel like gave Finish Line an identity with social and just kind of recreated how a lot of brands were approaching social and content.
Yeah, man, it's crazy to see where things are now, and I'm guilty of this too, but it's crazy to see how much stuff that is just repeated of stuff that I feel like through, you know, my career at, you know, Soul Collector, working with East Bay, obviously working with you at Complex and then Finish Line, I feel like we really shifted a lot of the thought process behind doors. Like I don't think the public facing side of what has to happen is just, you know, really showcases what has to be done behind the scenes to make these things happen. Because, you know, the analogy of the treehouse and the music, like that's the perfect example of like big business. And it's not even like big corporate business, like a Finish Line. It's like Complex is a big business, and there are certain things about it that still feel very suit and tie. And there is also, you know, to me, that was one of the cool experiences in my career, was like being the dude in like, you know, Dickies and sneakers on the elevator with a bunch of suits going higher up, you know, like yeah. That was like one of those experiences where it's like, wow. And I think that, you know, speaking of like the culture of things and like how much, in my opinion, you bring that to wherever you're at. How do you balance the kind of the back and forth of like getting your shit done, but also not being so uptight about it that people don't want to work with you?
I mean, I don't know if there's like a perfect blueprint for it. You know, I just try and approach things with two things in mind. And one, that's just being true to myself. Like, you know, I always said that if I was going to do this, that it was going to be an extension almost of like kind of my childhood. Like, you know, if I'm going to be fortunate enough to be Tom Hanks and big and go out there and, you know, be able to do what I love every single day, then I want it to feel like that too. There's no reason to take it too serious. And I think the other big piece of it is just an emotional IQ thing, like knowing, all right, if I want people to believe in me and follow what I want to do and buy into, you know, kind of quote unquote our system, I got to make sure they're good. I got to make sure that they're happy. I need to make sure that they're feeling like they're growing and, you know, the things that are important to them are being fulfilled as well. And, you know, hasn't been perfect. I know that there's days where people probably were cursing me out to their significant others when they got home later that day, but it was all with a bigger purpose. And I'd like to at least think that, you know, we definitely had some really amazing, fun stories. Like, you know, as we're recording this, somebody who came up with us, who was very important, the Finish Line piece, Chris Elliott, you know, he just left the company and he's moving on to, you know, new challenges, new adventures. And, you know, I see Kim Nguyen, who, if you know Finish Line Social, you know her, 317 Kim, also one of our favorite people, you know, posting like all these like pictures and memories and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, we accomplished a lot, but we created this like little family, this bond that isn't going to go away even when we go in different directions. And to me, you know, being the best in class for your brand, that's the ultimate goal on the business side. But, you know, creating that kind of love for each other, like that's the thing that's really most important. That's the stuff you're going to remember in 15, 20 years. So, you know, it's just being true to yourself and making sure you look out for other people, because it's not just about you.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's such an overrated thing. And I think going back to, you know, our Complex days, even like we had people like Joe, Russ Bankston, NCB, Jack Irwin, like all those people kind of had that vibe as well. you know, we almost like I feel like you and I had that for ourselves, but then going in and finding people that also like if you really fuck with somebody, you really fuck with somebody. Like, that doesn't mean just when it's working hours or just when you've got to like knock out, you know, some crazy amount of work and it's like, okay, cool, let's go get a drink afterwards. But it's like, there are people that, you know, and you lose touch with people over time sometimes, but there are people, you know, like Joe being a good example. I just ran into him and up on Sunset talking to him about sneaker shopping and all that stuff. And first thing he says to me is, you know, like daps me up and then like hugs me and basically says, sorry, I missed your birthday. And like, that's the kind of thing that I think, take away all the sneaker stuff, take away all the material shit. We crave that. And I think like, you know, I'm thankful for you as a friend to just have that, like I could hit the wall head on full speed and know that like, I could call you up and be like, yo man, I just got to talk through some shit. And to have that, I think that there's a lot of hesitation for people in corporate environments to like let down their guard or become friends with people that they work with. And for me, and you know, sounds like for you, I approach it the exact opposite. Like, hey, if we're going into this war together, we're going into this war together and we're going to come out on the other side together, because that's where the real value is. Like, you want to walk away from something, you know, whether it's a job or a project or a campaign, and look around and be like, yeah, we did that shit. And I think that's something that I think is underappreciated and almost like overlooked because of the big, you know, kind of, I don't know, people are just afraid to be like human in a, they like want to put on the job role and not let people into their world. But kind of going back to that complex stuff, I wanted to just like reiterate the amount of effort that we had to put in to, like, I know you put in probably more effort than most people have ever put in. No knock to anybody, but back in the day, I think it was people don't know that you worked a full-time job as you were doing that stuff. Like, you worked a full-time job, you know, 40 hours a week, and then complex 40 hours a week at night, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I worked a normal like 8:30 to 5 o'clock day. I'd come home, usually turn on ESPN, and I kind of had like this battle station. I had this swivel TV on the right side that could either face my bed or my computer. And I felt like it was always facing my computer, and I was just sitting there always working on stuff. And yeah, I'd say from like 5:30 to 2 in the morning, I was usually working on complex stuff. And yeah, it was crazy. Like, looking back on it, I'm just like, wow, they really got a deal. But at the same time, like, I also tell people, you know, when they ask where I went to college, I'm like, I went to Complex University. Like, it prepared me for things that, you know, I still apply to this very day, even though that, you know, everything's changed significantly in the past decade. But, you know, having people like Joe and Russ at your disposal to teach you, and, you know, obviously yourself, you know, you were a big part of managing me there for like the last year. You know, why wouldn't you take advantage of that? Like, I knew that if I was going to shift from what I was doing 9 to 5 to really make a full commitment to this industry, that I was going to have to forego grabbing dinner with my friends, watching games, partying on the weekends and stuff like that. And, you know, not to get too far ahead of itself, but like, you know, one question I get is like, what's your biggest piece of advice to people? Be passionate about it. Be willing to outwork every other single person. I know that's some old advice, but, you know, board man really does get paid. If you're willing to do the things that other people aren't going to do, it puts you in a much better position to be valuable. So, you know, there was nights where I had to do transcriptions of interviews that I didn't even do, or, you know, even just being alert to the fact that Kanye, you know, rocking Yeezy 2s at Coachella, which actually I think Jonas was the one that put me onto that at like 3 in the morning. You know, it just, you did what you had to do. And that high you got the next day when Twitter was going crazy and your name's on the byline, like, there's no dollar amount that really equates to what that was. So it was kind of easy in its own right.
Yeah, I think too, what's interesting, you know, looking back at it, is all of that kind of extra effort, all of that paying attention, all in that, all of the, you know, kind of finger on the pulse of things and like the networking that went into that obviously turned into, you know, some great opportunity for you, your next step beyond Complex. Was there a point where you transitioned from maybe like the regular job into the sneaker stuff full time that you were like, when did you know? Was it like, did you feel like, did the job with Finish Line come and then you're like, yeah, transition into it?
I mean, it was the Finish Line thing. When it was all said and done, you know, just to be honest, it was about money. And I just knew that I couldn't really make enough to survive off of being a freelance writer. And, you know, for the people that are just straight up freelance people, like, I have the most respect and admiration for you guys. I don't know if I have the stomach for it. Like, it's, you know, that consistency and, you know, just knowing that you're going to be good. That was always important to me. So when the Finish Line opportunity came, that's when I knew, like, all right, yeah, I'm doing all right at this. So, like, let's see how far I can really go. Worst case scenario, I can always fall back and do what I was doing if I want to.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy because, I mean, I don't think people understand the money that isn't there freelancing, especially back then, because there was somebody willing to do something for half of what you did, a quarter of what you would do it for. And, you know, it's hard work. It was a lot of research. I mean, but I also think it's important to reiterate too, that you did all of this stuff and basically, like, I mean, you mentioned Whip from Finish Line kind of introducing you to the company, but like that probably doesn't happen unless you put in all that work anyway. You don't know who's watching. You don't know how that's going to open a door.
Yeah. I mean, haven't talked to this guy in a while, but I'll put the name out there because he deserves the respect. I mean, it was Don Drew, who, you know, if you're a sneaker fan on Twitter, you've definitely seen a few of his hot takes. You know, I think he was the one that kind of reached out and was like, you guys need to get familiar with this person. And, you know, I appreciate that every single day because, you know, I don't know if I would have just put in an application if that would have got me where it would have went. And I mean, that's just the reality of life too. Obviously, having those relationships are going to take you a lot further than anything that you can put on paper.
Yeah, most definitely. Is there any kind of stepping back to, you know, talking about people being frustrated with you? I know you say it like sarcastically, because most people don't ever get frustrated with you, but was there any particular moment or situation where in the moment you were just like, the fuck this shit, I'm out meme, done with it all, that you look back on where you're like, kind of think differently about it now?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest turning points for me when I was at Finish Line was, and you know, you were there at the same time. I think you, actually it was right after you left, I'm sorry. But we were having this big battle where on social, we wanted it to be best of class. Like that was what we were saying internally. Like this really needs to be like our latest and greatest was the phrase that was used a lot. But then there would be pressure to put on, you know, sorry Adidas, but spring blades all over your A1 social stuff. And it's just like, well, that doesn't equate because that's not an A1 sneaker. And, you know, we kept having that back and forth. And with me, it's always been about the content. It's always been about the authenticity. It's always been about being proud of the work that you're doing. Because to me, you know, it matters more what a man makes than how much a man makes. Like, you should always be able to stand behind what you're doing and feel amazing about it. And I remember, you know, having a meeting with another part of the business and, you know, literally getting to the point where I was so angry that I almost burst into tears and had to excuse myself from the meeting. And, you know, for what it's worth, I don't believe that's ever happened to me before. And it was actually that moment that let leadership see, like, this guy isn't doing this to be right. He's not doing it for any other purpose than making us the best version of what we can be in that instance. And yeah, man, like I'm glad that I fought for those moments. And I'm glad that, you know, we had people like Paul Deal. We had people like Andy Wires, you know, a lot of really good guys in the building who were able to take a step back and be like, all right, let's let you guys drive this for a little bit. Worst case scenario, we can always switch it back up. And I felt like that was really a pinnacle moment where like things really opened up for what we were doing with the content.
You guys made like a noticeable shift. And I'm assuming, you know, I wasn't there, but I'm assuming it was around that point, because I think, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it's just so important to be passionate about it. And, you know, I would say also to be smart about your delivery and, you know when to stay quiet, know when to speak up, know when the you know, juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak. Right. Because that's always something that's challenging. And I think even going back to, you know, the Twitter 2011 Twitter kind of stuff, or even prior to that, right? Like the early years of Twitter, I think I got on 2009.
Same.
And it really was like a community, right? Like it felt like Nike Talk back in the day. It felt like the Soul Collector forums back in the day, where it was like, okay, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to talk to these same, you know, 30, 40 people. Somebody else is going to jump in, I'm going to make a new friend. Mm-hmm. But it became this place where people just wanted to wild out. And I think looking at that, you and I have our moments of wilding out and talking shit and letting it fly. And I think that's important to show people, because, you know, it is like getting frustrated in that situation to me is like, sometimes you have to hit that boiling point in order for people to understand that that's what it's really about. We're programmed to say like, oh, this person wants to just argue with me. Like that's what we're taught through all of the bullshit that's out there in the world. But thinking about that, a lot of what you've done over the years has been, you know, has involved obviously tons of different content plays, marketing plays, brand deals. But like product seeding has always been like something that you've worked pretty closely with, or your team has worked pretty closely with. So how do you look at, like, let's say the people on Twitter that just run their mouth, the people on social that say some questionable shit, versus, you know, getting past the bullshit or putting up with the bullshit to like understand what they're really about, and like maybe speak on the, like, the importance of those relationships? Because I know that you do it much differently, and I know we took a different approach to it with Finish Line when we started that. So,
yeah, I mean, for me, I was never overly attached to the numbers or the history of what somebody was able to do. For me, I've never really loved the whole term influencer. And I know that's easy to say in 2019, everybody's so disgusted with it. But I mean, you remember, like, even when we were there, like, I refused to call it that. I always called it our content creation team. And the main reason that maybe we were kind of forced to go there is we didn't really have the firepower internally to do that kind of stuff. And to me, it's like, cool, people know you, you have these hot takes on Twitter, that's great and everything, it's polarizing, but what can you create that I can't create, that I can't see? And I remember, I'm gonna outdate myself a little bit, I'm a big fan of like the Diddy Making the Band series. Like that was, I still to this day go back and watch it sometimes. It's pure gold. I mean, there's a reason Chappelle was able to make such a great skit about it. But the episode where Wyclef comes in and him kind of breaking down, and I didn't think about it at the time until I saw it, but him breaking down how he more so liked to work with new talent. He didn't like to pair with big names all the time. That's why you didn't see him on a lot of records with people like that, because he felt like he could really help influence these records and mentor these people and get more out of it than just, you know, another gold plaque or whatever it looks like. So I kind of took the same approach. I'm like, well, who are these up and coming hungry people who I feel like are able to create something that maybe nobody else is able to create? And, you know, before Instagram really was just this place for like a lot of photography, because that's where it started off. We didn't have all these cool editing techniques and manipulations, or at least people weren't really using it. It was just who could create like the cleanest photo. I was still really like high on the writing, and that's probably why our blog was so strong. So you see somebody like, you know, A to the Bed, Anna Bedions, who, you know, just posting some cool sneaker stuff. And then I come across this article that she had wrote about Beyonce that was kind of tied back with like street culture and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, this is fire. Boom. All of a sudden we're connecting. We're talking about doing stuff together. As things evolved, you know, I've realized the visual aspect of it was more and more important. And yeah, it was just kind of like seeking out these people who didn't already have relationships, who you could tell were genuinely about what was going on versus just trying to become popular or famous, and just really connecting with them so that there could be true collaboration. And anybody that knows me, you know, what do? I don't really know sometimes. Like, I'm not an editor. I don't have all these technical skills, but I feel like I'm great at understanding what there's a need for and helping develop a creative idea that's going to build into something a little bit better. And, you know, just thankful to have those relationships and have those outlets to get out some of my ideas as well that I know I probably could have never executed on my own.
Great advice for people looking at this kind of stuff, because there's so much of the, there's so much to just like send out the product, look for the numbers, and you can't play that game because somebody always has more money. Somebody always has more shit to send out. And at the end of the day, you're going to want to do this again if it's, if, you know, if you have a relationship with a person, right? Like you want to build on what you're doing. You don't want to just be like, cool, like I sent you a pair of shoes and, or I sent you, you know, a pair of sweats or whatever. And you posted, it's like that, that doesn't really, you, everybody has that creative kind of itch in a sense. And I think that collaborative effort always results in, you know, bigger and better. But it's also weird because now you see so much of the, you know, and I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but like all the brands, most of the retailers do it where it's like, cool, we got a new product that needs to get out. There's 40 pairs. And next thing you know, like you see it in the feed, all 40 people that got it. And you know that none of those people really care about it. So one of the things I wanted to kind of talk about was, you know, I know you and I had the conversation, and I think this is a conversation that people could benefit from on the business side, is that we would rather, we basically talk through, you know, seeding product and all the projects that we were going to work on. But most importantly, like reaching out to somebody and like understanding if they actually liked the product that you were going to send, where that just didn't seem to exist before, you know, like before we started doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't always a perfect situation. I mean, sometimes your most frequent collaborators had to eat their vegetables and, you know, you just give them a shoe that they probably didn't love because you had to get it done. But yeah, I mean, like that was the most important piece for us. And I felt like that's why what we did at that time really stood out, is because it did feel authentic. It felt very original. It felt really good. Like, I still think about the Air Max piece that Fomer did. Like, I know we referenced that a million times. And I mean, Dare to Air, Mr. Fomer Simpson, Google it. Like, you know, I know now it might not feel like it, but at the time, you know, feeling that from Fomer and seeing the visuals that went along with it, like that was kind of like, we knew we were able and capable of producing things with these people that, you know, the brands were spending 20 times the money doing. And we were just looking at it through a different lens. And, you know, not to go too far down the hole, but one of the coolest things that ever happened while I was at Finish Line is, you know, we had a director who said, if Nike gave us money to create content, like that was success to them. That happened less than a year after that. And it was based off those things, because they realized instead of having to go to an agency and spend six figures, Finish Line can get it done for, you know, a 20th of that. And it was just one of the coolest things that we really did.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, just to give a little background on how that process works for people that aren't familiar. So let's say you work for Finish Line, like Brandon and I did back in the day. The way it works is that a brand like Nike or Adidas is going to release product, and they're going to have a certain amount of budget to create content, to, you know, spend on advertising, blah, blah, blah. In most cases, what they do is they, you know, might give a little bit of money for Finish Line to advertise, like some sort of co-branded advertising spot, or, you know, maybe some wall displays or something like that in the stores, maybe some ads on the subway in New York or something, wherever. But they take a huge chunk of change and give it to an agency. That agency goes and spends the money to advertise the product that's not necessarily connected to Finish Line, but it's exclusively available at Finish Line. So before, and I don't want to take, you know, full credit for any of this, but like before we got there, I don't think that was happening from the Nike side, right? Like that was a very like,
I don't think it was really happening anywhere.
Yeah. So what we tried to do was plan out the content, the marketing, and like basically just the whole campaign so that we could pitch to the brands to say, don't give that money to an agency. Give that money to us at Finish Line and let our people do what we do best, and let us get it to the people that we know are going to go out and do some cool shit with it. And I think that you know, that's definitely one of the more, one of my most, you know, the things I'm most proud of. I think that it really, especially going into it, I didn't fully understand how it all worked. I mean, I knew a little bit, I knew the story of how it worked, but then to get in there and kind of understand it was a game changer for me.
I think that was the blessing, low key though. Like, we were kind of too stupid to know what we were doing. So we're like, our approach was almost like, well, if we were marketing to a bunch of our friends who are really into sneakers, this is how we would do it. And, you know, you don't know what's behind the doors at brands, what they're working on, what their next year strategy looks like. But I mean, if you do a deep dive, you can see what we were doing started to directly influence and impact the brands that we were technically working for. And we kind of led that a little bit. And, you know, like you said, to me, that was one of the things I was most proud of, like to be able to see a shift in some of these iconic brands based off of what we were doing when we really didn't know what we were doing. But we always trusted ourselves. We always trusted our instincts. We trusted our friends, because that's the reality. Like, the one thing I'll say, you know, kind of going to this seeding influencer thing, how do I become an influencer? Become best friends with the person that's in charge of taking care of the stuff for the brand. Like, that's just the reality. 70% of those gatekeepers are just hooking their buddies up. And I mean, obviously don't go out there and have some, you know, ill intentions to try and connect with people, but I mean, that's just how it is. And we bet on the house and, you know, we came out of it really solid.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that the becoming best friends with whoever that gatekeeper is, you know, it works that way in, you know, getting a free pair of shoes. It works that way in getting a job. It works that way in everything in life, right? Like, the better relationship you can have with somebody, the more opportunity you have to do cool shit with them. And I think that's what it always boils down to. So we have this kind of mentality as a whole, as society, to just be like, okay, I just need to follow the right person on social and eventually they'll notice, or I'll slide into the DMs. And I would say that 99% of the time, just blindly, you know, shooting from the hip, trying to get somebody's attention doesn't work. But if you slide into my DMs talking about some Sour Patch Kids, you got me, right? Like, if I hit you up about some chicken wings, it's in. Like, yeah, we're not talking about sneakers, but that starts to build rapport. And next thing you know, the sneaker conversations happen, the creative stuff happens. And I think that that's something that everybody listening could definitely keep in mind and take away from this conversation. But
I mean, on top of that too, just to add another layer to it, you know, obviously we're not trying to pretend like myself or anybody's that big of a deal in these situations, but you know, you do get hit up pretty frequently, and most people that are contacting you, they're wanting something from you and you don't know them. And that's not an easy position to be in. Like, how can I really invest in you when I don't really know you? You know, one of the things that NCB at Complex taught me when I first started off was always being willing to offer up way more than I would get back in return, because that's how you kind of bridge that gap. And, you know, one of my favorite, you know, always got to bring up Kanye. One of my favorite Kanye quotes is, you know, the word using has such a negative connotation, but we all use each other. It's when you misuse people, that's when it becomes problematic. So it's like learning how do you, you know, use somebody without being a psychopath and make sure that both of you get something beneficial out of it. Like, that's how great relationships are born. That's how people look at you and be like, all right, you're adding something to the table too. Now let's start collaborating. Let's start connecting, because I know that you're going to bring something to the table just as much as I can.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, on top of that, the passion is where it comes in. Like, everybody's passionate about little things. And I say Sour Patch Kids and chicken wings jokingly, but like, that shit's real. Like, you and I would have conversations about those things with people that, you know, and if somebody can like enlighten us on something we don't know about it, or put us onto a new spot, those things go a long way. And I think, you know, whether you're looking for your first job in the sneaker business or, you know, looking to become the next CEO at some startup, that's the stuff that really matters, is like, and shines, because it stands out from all the people that are just asking for the freebies. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the Dare to Air campaign, and obviously, you know, this could be Finish Line, Complex, who you mentioned, the 10-year magazine, but what are, like, say, one of one or two of your favorite campaigns that you worked on, articles that you wrote?
They're both complex, to be honest with you. I think just because, you know, just like anything else, like it was so new, everything had like a more weighted, you know, impact on me. It was so fun. It was such an awesome opportunity. And, you know, as you get older, as you do things more and more, you're a human being, you get desensitized to it a little bit. So number one, Fresh Prince. For those that don't know, who haven't seen it, I kind of wish I could get back with Complex and recreate it, because when you go on the site, it's very broken because, you know, it was 8 years ago. It was just a different back end. But I went through every episode. I ID'd every sneaker that was in there, wrote little blurbs about it. I remember it might be kind of cringeworthy, but I remember kind of like for the intro to the feature, like made a little play on like the rap for the intro of the song and like made it my own version. And it was just dope. I remember, like, I wasn't the first one to think of that, for the record. You know, rest in peace, Gary Warnett. He was the first one to do it with Seinfeld. That's probably the greatest feature, in my opinion, maybe the greatest sneaker feature of all time. He had the right foresight to basically tell Complex to fuck off when they asked him to do another one, because it's just, it's a lot of work. I mean, sitting there through 100+ episodes of a television show, yeah, it's just a difficult thing to do. But the way everybody reacted when that came out, just how that was received, you know, there's times where I'm even in an Uber right now and, you know, people just making small talk. What have you done? And I wrote a Complex. Oh, what was your favorite thing you wrote? Fresh Prince feature. Oh my gosh, I know that, you know, like that's a really fun feeling. The other one, a little bit more bittersweet, but I just, for whatever reason, I can remember this one more vividly than the others. A couple months after I'd started there, we did a March Madness, like top 25 sneakers and, you know, NCAA history. And obviously there's some really iconic stuff that you pull back from the 80s, 90s. I remember at the time, you know, you're talking about doing the features and then being a lot of work. You're not wrong. Like there's times where it's 1:30 in the morning and you're still trying to pull art for certain things. And this is 2011. Everything's not on the internet yet. It's still kind of tough to find certain things. And, you know, I remember working on this feature with Russ Bengston, and this was kind of my first introduction to Russ and how much of a, you know, smart person he was and just really understood it and just a true historian. He pulls out this picture of Donovan McNabb playing for Syracuse. And I was like, I didn't even know he played basketball for Syracuse. So that was kind of one of my favorite parts of doing the research, was I didn't know everything. Like I was still learning stuff as I was going. I just 90% of it, I knew where to start because I love sneakers that much too. So we're working on the feature. We're feeling good about it. I'm very, very biased. I think it's Bibby and the Foamposites, because I was such a big Penny Hardaway fan. That's still my favorite basketball team of all time. Miles Simon is my favorite college basketball player, even though he wore the Uptempos. But I remember I'm like, this is one, like what? Like they debuted them in the Final Four. Like they got hooked up before Penny did. And Russ is like, no, we got to find Ewing and the Terminator. Like that's the greatest shoe of all time. I'm like, you're not wrong. You know, me being a huge Hoya fan, we're searching. And I think, you know, we were usually last minute trying to, like, that morning it was supposed to go live, trying to finish editing and stuff. But this one we planned out pretty well. So we're trying for a while. And even back then, I remember, like, we weren't opposed to doing watermark photos. So even if it had that, like, terrible Getty Images watermark across it, we were using it. Couldn't find it. Feature comes out. People love it. It's amazing. I remember being at my regular job and all of a sudden, you know, one of my best friends from back home, Matt Zumdahl, hits me up. He's like, oh my gosh, dude, turn on ESPN right now. And I'm like, I'm at work. I can't see it. And he, you know, videoed from his phone. The article actually made it on PTI. And, you know, after you win PTI, you basically get like 30 seconds to talk about whatever you want. I can't remember the guy's name. It was Kevin something. And he basically was just like, Complex Magazine came out with this article and, you know, kind of seemed awesome. He's like, but they got one thing wrong. And it was, he felt Ewing and the Terminator should have been one too. I just remember getting a DM from Russ. I effing told you, with like 45 exclamation marks. And that's kind of when I realized too, like whatever Russ says goes, like, it's just that simple.
Shout out to Russ, man. I gotta actually get him on the podcast, because I feel like we could have a pretty good conversation.
Man, you might have to make that like a 3-hour episode, like a 3-part series.
Yeah. It's crazy though to think back of all the, like, I don't think that the formula is any different now. I think that yes, finding things on the internet was much more difficult back then. You know, you couldn't search Nike Talk. You had to dig through pages and pages and pages and stuff to find things. And even back, you know, it sounds crazy, but like this is 5 years ago, but Getty Images didn't even have most of their images online. They had a big database of images, but there's new stuff in there all the time. So I want to kind of just point out that, like, if you're doing stuff in the sneaker world, even to this day, it's just a matter of how far you're willing to go to find that information to tell that story, right? Because there's always a little bit more out there that people don't know. Everybody seems to tell the same stories over and over again. Like, classic case is like, this is sneaker history is basically the same shit over and over again. I just happen to love it enough to like keep looking for new ways to talk about it and to get new people excited about it. But I think that that's like a key takeaway of what you're talking about right there, where it's just like, you can just keep going. You can find more, like you can go a little bit further. It's the same way, you know, not to compare, but like athletes or entertainers, like you just leave it all out there. And like, the further you go, the more value you're going to bring. And eventually someone like ESPN is going to recognize it and see this stuff. And I mean, I remember the first time for myself with articles like that, I was actually just talking to Joe about that, because like it was such a crazy experience. You know, now, you know, I mean, I worked with Nick DiPaolo for years, but like now he's got, you know, regular recurring segments on ESPN, wow, which is crazy.
Nick made it.
Yeah. I mean, it's super dope. Like, honestly, I don't know that I would want to be on TV like that kind of stuff, but the excitement that, you know, we would find back then, the same kind of thing happens now, right? On a different scale. And I think it just translates into, you know, for some people, it's like I posted my shoes and Bleacher Report reposted. For some people, it's still that ESPN. For some people, like thinking about like Russ Bengston, right? Like, he's going to want to write something and have the New York Times be talking about it. You know, like there's just levels to like what you're doing, but everybody's trying to kind of chase that like elusive nugget of information that they can kind of bring in and present in a new way. But so I guess like maybe two more questions and we'll wrap up. But what would be something that, you know, speaking about passion and like, and you know, that drive, what would be something that you find motivation or inspiration in that might be a little untraditional?
I mean, I don't think it's like anything unique or whatever, but I'll just literally go on YouTube sometimes with no other agenda other than like starting off with like, all right, what were some of my favorite music videos growing up? And then all of a sudden I'm in this like Hype Williams like spiral where I'm looking at stuff like that. And, you know, I'm not going to speak on specific projects, but they've influenced a lot of things that I've done. And like, it doesn't take you like racking your brain to make it happen either. Like, it's just very organic. Like, this is what I love. How do I repurpose this into something that, you know, I can do and separate it from what's been done in the past and do something amazing? But I mean, my biggest thing when I'm kind of in that mode is I genuinely try and look back to things that I fell in love with, like that really made me feel a type of way that got me to where I'm at right now. And I start there and kind of work back to the present. And I mean, sometimes it's 3-4 hours straight and you're just taking a bunch of notes and, you know, your girl might walk in and be like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm working. Like, what do you think I'm doing? Like, I know it doesn't look like it, but I'm working. Like, this is my process. This is what I do. And, you know, it's just, it's so important to always educate yourself on things. And I know it sounds really cliche, but I'm not talking about going and taking classes and stuff like that. Obviously, for certain industries, it's important. But, you know, especially in this industry, like knowing the culture, knowing the history, like those two things are so important. There's been so many times where I've sat in rooms where people maybe didn't fully understand that stuff. And, you know, it kind of slows down the process. It takes a lot of the steam out of things. So like, you know, even speaking back to working with other people and collaborating, like that was one thing that I always kind of prided myself on is like, you're not going to beat me on that. You know, I want that first to show up, last to leave mentality. And just like, I know everything backwards, forwards, sideways, a million times over because I prepared myself for it.
Great, great advice. I think that's something that you and I connected on, you know, like thinking back to the Complex days, right? I mean, it was absolutely 100% the hardest work of my life. The most time, the most energy, but I felt like you were right there with me the whole time. So it was like, all right, it's good. You
know, we'd have phone calls at 1:30 in the morning and be like, why are you up? I'm working. Like, we're going to kill this. This feature is going to be like our big thing too. Like, keep it real. Like, we wanted to make Joe proud. Like, we wanted the sneaker team to always have the best feature on the site so that he could, you know, can't fuck with us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, man. Definitely. So taking it a little bit different direction, what, you know, if you were to either, let's say, get a chance to, let's say a brand comes to you, any brand you want, comes to you and says, we're going to make the next version of this person's signature shoe or this person's retro, whatever it is, what shoe would it be for you? And what part of that would you want to be involved in?
Wow, that's probably one of the best questions anybody's ever asked me. I mean, I got to be honest, and it's the Reebok answer one. Like, that was my shoe growing up. I still have original pairs from 97. I remember convincing my mom to get me a third pair because I was just running through them playing so much basketball outdoors, especially that, you know, I had to keep getting them. And, you know, they re-released the shoe. It's cool. It's all right. It looked good. But anybody that played in that shoe in 97 with that true DMX system, the way it was created, like, you're just hyper-focused on the brand if you're not giving that enough love. Like, that's just the reality of it. And especially with how, you know, more like the technical fashion stuff really came into play from an aesthetic standpoint, I just felt like they could have did a lot of cool things with that design, really transformed that into something a little bit more special than slapping it together with another answer and making it a hybrid sneaker. You know, like I said earlier, I'm not a designer. I'm not really that hands-on of a creative, but there's some people out there who, you know, and that's what I love about design in general. Like, you know, people like Brett, who you've had on the show before, who works on cars now, like, you can find these people who have different kind of backgrounds of design. And that's my favorite thing to do, period, is finding talent to collaborate with that you probably never would have guessed with. And I think just having an opportunity to work on that project, bring back some of the apparel that came with that stuff. I mean, it's that or the tweet I sent you the other day, and one, like the original and one stuff, like the original shorts, the original tees, the shoes. I get that it probably will never be what it was in, you know, the mid late 90s, but with this resurgence of so many things, like I would have loved to seen that done properly. And, you know, that was just a brand at that time that I was, every time I went in the store and they had shorts, you know, $45 a pop, mom, pull out that credit card, we're getting, you know, like, it just wasn't even a question and she knew it.
Yeah, man. Yo, heavyweight and one shorts from like 99, 2000, still the best to me. Like, I would buy them every day.
I mean, I still have a pair of the original, like, navy and green ones that were kind of a staple. I think Mulberry wore them in one of the ads. I mean, they have no drawstring. I can't keep them up. But, like, just, you know, like, some people might have, like, their blankie from when they were a little kid. Like, that's my blankie. Like, I keep that around because it just takes me back to being 13 years old, shooting until it was pitch dark out and you didn't care, watching NBA playoff games on TNT. And as soon as they were over, they'd show the same rerun of Above the Rim over and over and over with the same terrible edits. And I mean, you didn't care because, like, ball really was life. And, you know, I'm so fortunate that a love for a sport even got me as far as it did.
Yeah, man. It was definitely an amazing era, in my opinion. So would Jadakiss be a part of that? That if you got to bring back the answer one properly?
I mean, well, he was on what the answer
on the five
commercial. Yeah. I mean, Jada can throw bars whenever he wants. He's just, even if we just get a couple ad libs from Jada, that's good. But it's funny you bring that up. I can't even remember what commercial it was. I'm going to end up texting you about it outside of this. But there was a Reebok spot like 98, 99. I want to say 98 that had a rapper in it. I can't remember who it was, but I remember thinking, I'm like, Jada commercial was kind of iconic for a reason because it was cool to pair them up. This is just straight flames. Like, these are actual really good bars. Yeah. And this doesn't feel like a commercial. It feel like Reebok took like 30 seconds of a dope underground song and put it out there. I got to look that up. That's going to really bother me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes when we find it. All right. So Last question. If you were going to give somebody a shoe to like get them started, whether it be in the sneaker game, however you want to look at sneaker game as a collector, as a fan, as a career, what shoe would it be and why?
Honestly, this, like the purest side of me wants to say Jordan 1, just because, I mean, Jordan 1s are for a variety of reasons. Like you can fashionably skate, whatever, so many different color templates. It always looks good. Like you don't have to be a sharp dude to make a Jordan 1 look pretty nice. But the ones I would say, actually, the original Ronnie Fox stuff with A6. And the reason I bring that one up is because to this day, when I wear those shoes out, people literally turn their heads sometimes. They're like, what are those? And like people that aren't really into sneakers are just like, those are the coolest things I've ever seen. So when you're walking down the street, I mean, you know it. Like anytime somebody gives you a compliment just out of the blue for nothing really significant, it kind of gives you like this source of pride, like this good feeling. So just so people could feel that like, oh, wow, I really got some heat on my feet. Like, yeah. Throw back some like the Coves, some of the original Ronnie Fieg shoes, because those really were on a different level at the time.
Yeah, that's dope, man. I agree. And if you're listening, just, you know, go compliment somebody on their sneakers today, because it's going to make somebody's day and you never know how far that'll go. So, it was dope catching up with you, man. I appreciate you taking the time. And why don't you let everybody know how they can find you on social?
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me. It's kind of cool to actually have this on wax instead of just our normal conversations. But if you're trying to find me on social, it's MRBrando3, both Twitter and Instagram. Nothing too exciting, to be honest with you. But, you know, honestly, like, I would love for more people to interact with me, ask questions, have conversations, versus I just kind of got bored posting stuff and just seeing how people are going to respond to it. Like, it just gets a little bit old.
Yeah, man, I feel you. It's all about the connection and the relationship and how people can kind of inspire each other. So hopefully this conversation did that. And we'll catch up with y'all in the future. Peace.
What up, y'all? This is Nick again. Before you take off, I just want to thank you again for listening to this episode of the Sneaker History Podcast. Remember, you can save 15% on Shrine Co. bags with the code HISTORY15 at the website theshrine.co, theshrine.co. If you enjoyed this episode, consider leaving us a review on iTunes. And if you want even more sneaker history content, join our Patreon page for exclusive episodes and merchandise. As always, thank you for the support, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.
Hey, Nick here again. Before you take off, I want to thank you for listening to the Sneaker History Podcast. Be sure to hop into our Discord to answer this episode's The Last Shot question and get to know our community of sneaker enthusiasts. If you'd like more insights on the trending topics in the sneaker world, I've also recently started a newsletter to share my knowledge from nearly 2 decades of experience working in the footwear industry. You can find the link to that below or go to sneakerhistory.com/newsletter. And last but not least, tell someone you like their kicks today. You never know how far a simple compliment can take you, and we all know how good it feels to be on the receiving end of some appreciation. Thank you for all the support, and we will catch you on the next episode. Peace.